The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Pete got promoted as the person who stole the least. Rand's robotic rovers beat bi-static backscatter. Ron's vast portfolio changes the global face of cybersecurity. A pitcher returns full of fuel, more fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. As the World Court convened, we saw both sides increase their online rhetoric. Hamas supporters claimed the accusations of genocide was proof it was real. Israeli supporters claimed that the UN and its judges were biased. Meanwhile, the court operated in a normal, efficient manner with both sides and the judges politely making their points. The news is, the system does not seem to be breaking.
How do we know we're being successful at The Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One. We know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening. Frauds, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them. It's the name of a book, and now it's the name of a segment on our show. We've previously talked on the show about people on social media sites that introduce themselves, claim to be some sort of a friend, and try to move you to discuss things on WeChat or one of these other similar channels. At that time, I was unaware of some of the underlying details of what's going on here. But a recent news story made it abundantly clear what's really happening.
According to the New York Times, there is a global kidnapping criminal enterprise that starts by offering people a job, paying them for a brief period, then sponsoring paid travel overseas for corporate training. But when they get there, they find themselves enslaved. Yes, that's right. Human trafficking using online job applications as the lure, remote work as the starting point, and global travel for training as the hook. When you arrive, you get on the transport, and end up in a slave labor camp. Barred windows and doors. Men in combat fatigues, carrying rifles, guarding the main entrance. High walls and fences topped with razor wire surrounding the compound.
So when I talked about this previously, I was discussing how people were taking advantage and trying to scam you. I had no idea that they were being forced to do it. This is an astonishing revelation in my mind about how severe the online cyber criminal world has become and how much organized crime has come to enter it. We've known for a long time that there are organized groups doing verticals for things like spam, taking money from checking accounts, stealing information, and then selling it to third parties for various sorts of exploitation. But this is a whole new level of obscene, disgusting, disgraceful behavior.
More than 100,000 people have been enslaved by this criminal enterprise.
Okay, we're now talking about numbers that are very large. More than 100,000 people means that it's not just some organized group doing it somewhere. It's not an underground activity. It must be either supported or condoned by the police, and not just the local police. To get to that sort of volume, it has to be something that's being allowed on a national basis, you know, with military support or some such thing.
And what do they do in these labor camps? They carry out complicated online scams around the world. They use fake online identities to draw people into fictitious romantic relationships, then trick them into paying large sums in fraudulent cryptocurrency schemes, also called pig butchering,
So in volumes this high, 100,000 plus different people using probably multiple identities each, so there are probably millions of identities involved, you would think that the social media companies would be able to detect this, especially because the patterns are so similar and the efforts are so scripted. In fact, of course, these are being sent as text messages, not voice, so it's very easy to detect. And all the social media companies have to do is look for these common sequences of words. I mean, they're almost identical wording from many of these, and rapidly detect that there are multiple identities originating seemingly identical sentences. At that point, you should be able to rapidly detect and eliminate those identities, although eliminating the identities might not be the right idea. It might be a much better idea to consume their resources in failed efforts. For example, you could put all of those people that are using these techniques into an isolated area and automate responses to them so that every time they try something, it seems to succeed, and they waste lots and lots of time and effort. All that time and effort goes for naught, and the criminal enterprises fail until they adapt, at least.
In the United States, the FBI reported that in 2022, Americans lost more than $2 billion to pig butchering and other investment scams. People from India, the Philippines, and more than a dozen other countries have been kidnapped and trafficked to work as slaves in these enterprises that Interpol calls a global security threat. These scams tend to use stolen accounts on WeChat and other similar social communication sites. And that is one of the reasons you will see them finding you on sites like Facebook or LinkedIn and switching to WeChat, where their stolen accounts are lost among the billion-plus Chinese and other nation-state accounts on that system. In another media story by Reuters, fake profiles on Tinder, WhatsApp, and Facebook were created by kidnapped Africans and Filipinos. Most of these labor camps are apparently in Cambodia near the Myanmar border.
I should also note that because of the locations of these things, there's a tendency for the communications to originate from internet service providers and internet protocol addresses that are relatively easy to determine. They're typically not going to go through proxies, and if they do, they're going to use a relatively small number of proxies so that their ability to diffuse the address information is quite limited. Furthermore, if you're at one of these social media sites, you can see if people are using many different internet protocol addresses to communicate for the same person. If this happens in a very short period of time, then you know it's a proxy and it's doing things on a session basis. And if it's not that, you can, of course, cut off the IP addresses or reroute the IP addresses very easily at a firewall into a deception network. Every week, we'll feature another cyber fraud to help keep you aware of what's going on and what you can do about it. If you'd like to read the book, Fraud, Spies, and Lies, and How to Defeat Them, it's available online at all.net under books. That's ALL.NET, and you press on books. This segment is called, How Do They Do That? While threat actors already know how, many executives don't believe it's possible. We explain it so even a CEO can understand it. These criminal organizations are rather large and complex compared to the old school individual or small group operations normally considered in the cyber arena and associated with hackers or crackers or whatever you want to call them. There are also multiple components to their efforts, many of which may be verticalized. For example, there are specialists in stealing WeChat identities that may break into sites or involve insiders at WeChat using simple methods like bribery or extortion. China has implemented human identification processes to associate such accounts to individuals, so it's not that easy to exploit it as it is to exploit companies like LinkedIn and Facebook, which will essentially take any email address and allow it to be granted an identity on their platform. Getting an email address is as simple as going to any internet domain owner and asking for one. Many have free email services to gain customers. And of course, if you have broken into computers, you can use the identities from those computers to gain more identities. So how do you break into these computers? Well, there are criminal groups, for example, that break into computers all over the world and then lease these services on those computers to other criminal groups. This has been going on for more than 25 years and has become a verticalized industry. There are many other moving parts here, including the physical parts with compounds to keep prisoners and so on. But this gives you an idea of what's involved for large-scale criminal enterprises in this arena. And that's how you do that. Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies. Pete Herzog can best be characterized as a hacker. He's been a hacker since he was young. He's been on both sides of the line between good and evil, if you will call it that. And his career has affected a lot of people, all the more so since he started working on Open Standards and Hacker High School. Here's Pete.
By the way, did that ID lie about your age and therefore cause you to be fired or something like that? Or what?
No. It did make me slightly older. I was 17 at the time. I went to college at 17. So maybe by then I was 18. And it made me 21. And he was so interested in it that I was working third shift, by the way, which is from 10 p.m. till 6 a.m. And the reason why I did that was because they pay you 25 cents more the hour.
And you go to school during the day.
Exactly. And I would get back at 6. I would sleep till 10 when my first class was. And, you know, and then I would be there.
Yeah, I'm familiar with it, yeah.
Yeah. And then it started us talking, and he decided to move me into, so there was this, in the store, there was a back office. So with a big, you know, bolt on the door, a big heavy door with a tiny bulletproof window. And he said, I want you then, since you're in college and you seem to be clever, I want you to be counting the money and doing the inventory slips at night.
Okay. So just to be clear, they took the guy who admitted that he was, you know, doing something technically that might even be illegal, and said, you're the guy to count the money because you know. Okay. And by the way, this is the classic hire of the hacker by the corporation, right? They hired the person that knows how to break in instead of the person who's a security expert, because they think that somebody who knows how to break in knows more than the person who knows how to stop people from breaking in, right?
I think that was the case. So one of the things they also had was the district manager had told me that they have detectives who watch and see if people steal. So that's a huge problem for people who work at these mini marts, is that they steal.
Yeah, it's called shrinkage.
Exactly. And yeah. He said, and my problem was, because this is why they came, and he was firing people and talking to people. And he said that I stole the least. And
congratulations, Pete. You stole less than everybody else at the store.
So I stole no alcohol. I stole no cigarettes, which are their big markup items. But I stole the occasional candy bar and mostly the hot dogs that were on too long, you know, because they had hot dogs and burritos and stuff.
Once they get all dried out, they're disgusting. You don't want to sell them to a customer. You're supposed to throw them out.
Throw them away. And I ate them.
Oh, terrible, terrible crime. Normally, that's not just allowed, it's authorized.
I think he had trust in me because he saw that I was, I was smart and that I would think through things.
I'm a starving student, not a career criminal.
Exactly. And he actually encouraged me then.
Technically, you could be considered a career criminal, except that as you went through your life further, you weren't doing so many criminal acts. You were a career security expert,
which didn't really exist in my mind, or I don't even know if it even existed
in 1989.
Definitely not.
Okay, the classic security hire. He had the two most important properties. One of them, he was a crook, and the other one was he didn't steal as much from the company as everybody else.
Yeah, the old hire a thief to catch a thief. You know, this year we lost Kevin Mitnick, right? And Kevin was one of the first people to get really famous for getting caught hacking. And
he didn't just get caught. I mean, he got in jail.
right? And, early in my career, when all that was going on, I remember a lot of folks getting really adamant about that. Well, never hire him again. Now, and it's again, interesting moral stance. However, right, I got to know Kevin over the years and seemed like a good guy, right? And I know a lot of people who've done a lot of hacking, right, and hacking groups, and not ethical hacking, right?
Well, let's make it correct. They were illegally breaking into things.
Right, breaking into things, right?
That's not hacking, right? I mean, hacking is what is exploring and finding interesting things. And yeah, so they were criminal,
criminal attackers, right? It's fine. So
yeah, ish. Breaking laws, certainly. You know, not just faking ideas, but doing things and.
Well, and doing it typically for personal gain, and you know, to take money, and you know, taking things of value from others.
Not so much, though. I mean, it really is. You know, I can't say I don't know anybody who's done that, right? In ways, but most of the time, it really is. You know, the payoff is respect from their peers and so forth. You know, but you did break something, you broke into something, and you broke it illegally, right? So it you know, it's crossed the line, but.
You were talking about Kevin Mitnick, and I'll tell you the problem. I've said this, you know, sort of publicly some number of times. The problem is not that he was, you know, breaking into things. That's a problem too. But the problem is he actually ended up getting caught, arrested, convicted, and served jail time. And the reason that's a problem is not because of all those things. It's because he cannot be that good at what he does if he got caught. Okay, wow. You have to be a pretty lame attacker to get caught. Now, these days, maybe it's a little bit easier to get caught, but probably not. But in those days, I mean, you know, you really had to be a parent to be caught. You had to do something really obvious without trying to hide your tracks at all. But then, even if you got caught, I mean, the chances are, because this, you know, he did this very early in the game. The chances are what you did wasn't illegal or you know, might have been technically illegal, but, you know, there's lots of, you know, ways to say, you know, get around it.
You left the door open. I walked through it.
It's like, yeah, exactly. But even if it's illegal, you know, the chances of getting, you know, prosecuted for it are small because almost always you can, you know, talk to the prosecutor and say, all right, you know, how about if I do this instead? You can make a deal. But really, you didn't do that. And then, you know, the odds of getting convicted at trial, you know, if you have a decent lawyer, you know, that's even, especially for a computer crime at that time, which was just hard to explain, you know, to a jury, and the forensics were lousy. And if you had a good defense, but all of those things, he still managed to end up in jail, and not just like in jail, like overnight. You know, he was, I guess, in a federal prison for years. Right.
Right. And, getting back to, you know, our guest, you know, to Pete and so forth, the whole idea of, you know, hire a thief to catch a thief, you know, I think it was more of a conversation 30 years ago, and maybe it is still today. I don't know. Maybe I've just aged out of it, but it's not a very mature approach. But in the early days, you know, when Pete's talking about, yeah, where else are you going to find anybody who knows anything? It's probably more common in emerging fields. But yeah, I mean, yeah, to your point, you know, that still today, if you're really good, you're probably not going to get caught. You know, if you're really good, you know, and that's, you know, and I'm talking.
Come on. There's a trillion dollars. And that's a reasonably good figure from what I've, you know, asked people about and found out about $1 trillion a year of losses. And how many people get convicted of computer crimes?
Right.
Not very many. And very few computer criminals are billionaires. So it would take 1,000 billionaires to get to $1 trillion. And I bet there aren't 1,000 people convicted of computer crimes in the U.S. per year. Of course, we could look it up, but then that would be too easy. Maybe getting the internet.
Which, if nothing else, is a great empirical measure of how mature this industry is, because, you know, we're not even very good at catching people at it. Right? And it's not, there's not like, you know, two $500 billion hacks a year. There's, you know, break-ins. There's lots and lots of little tiny crimes. Oh,
yeah. So the average loss for corporations is in the, you know, big corporations, the $4 to $6 million range, something like that. So if there's $1 trillion and the average loss is, say, even if it's 10 million, you know, so that's 100 million, a billion, 1,000. So that's 100,000 of those things a year.
Right. And we just don't have the legal or the technical capability to prosecute them. Right. You know,
and those are the ones that are detected, right? Because right. I have to say, in all the red teaming stuff I've done, I never got detected. Actually, that's not true. I got detected twice, but.
Well,
when I say detected, that doesn't mean that they figured out what I was doing. It just means that they said, wait a minute.
You know, steal a car, and it's easy to tell because the car is missing. You know, you steal information, the car might still be there, but it's also been stolen. Right. So it's a more complex world.
There's also the punishment issue, right? Because the threshold for grand theft is $500, I believe, something like that. But for computer crime, it's more like 5,000. The actual statutes say it has to be 5,000 of damage, in some case more than that. But in order to interest a prosecutor in going after you or law enforcement and spending the time and effort it takes, you have to be pretty big. And I've had cases where, you know, we reported things to the police and we reported it to the prosecutor and they said, it's just, you know, I appreciate that. And all that evidence looks pretty good, but it's just not worth our time. We're not going to do that. And so you get the little crimes, they get away with enough of those. Eventually they become, you know, big crimes and get away with those perhaps. So, you know, as an industry, as a field, you know, as we've discussed at great length, we are so immature, it's pathetic.
Well, it's educational, but it's instructive, right? You know, that whichever side you're on, you know, if you're on the attack side or the defense side, knowing, you know, the state of the space informs a lot of what you need to do. You know, and you know, on the defense side, a lot of people, you know, a lot of CEOs, companies will say, "Oh my God, I want my company to be safe. You know, you're a cybersecurity person, make me safe." And they don't understand, right, what they're asking. They can see the doors and they can see the, you know, cameras and so forth, and they can think of the physical security, but they just don't understand the state of cybersecurity. And how could they?
Cognitive Defense is an emerging company helping other companies defend against malicious influence operations. They do this by helping people better defend themselves against exploitation. You can get in touch with Cognitive Defense by going to cogdef.com. That's cogdef.com, or find them through their link at thecybershow.co. We're talking with Rand Waltzman, who has a long history in the cybersecurity and artificial intelligence arena, and perhaps most importantly in the deception, counter-deception, influence operations, counter-influence operations, and related areas. Here is Rand.
After brain surgery, then what? Yeah.
Well, you know, then time had gone by and I did different things. And then I ended up in graduate school. No, that's not true. Actually, after that, my next experience was I started the graduate school and then I went to work. I took a job at the Applied Physics Laboratory at the University of Washington doing underwater acoustics, which I knew absolutely nothing about. So,
of course.
But I was a mathematician. I was a graduate student in applied mathematics. So they figured out you can learn whatever you need to know. So
wait, what was your undergraduate degree?
Was in math also. Was in
math. Okay, so all math. Yep.
Yeah, and then my master's. Then I entered as a PhD student in applied math, and I ended up at the University of Washington somehow. And let's see, I started working at this applied physics lab doing underwater acoustics. And actually, my next experience with computers was writing a program to analyze data from an experiment, an acoustic experiment they did. And it was for something called bistatic backscatter. So the way people studied backscatter in acoustics traditionally was you had one hydrophone, which sent a signal out, then you got a signal directly back. So that data was used to create an approximation for a bistatic backscatter where the signal, the sound was emitted from one machine, one hydrophone, and received at another. And then, so they say they made up some scheme to try to approximate what that would look like, what the loss would look like. And then that data was used to build simulations of acoustic simulations of hydrophones and their actions in shallow water. All the interest was in shallow water. So this group that I went to work for, they had the first actual set of experimental data where they really could do measurements of bistatic backscattering. So then the idea was to analyze the data. Now I had real backstatic data, real bistatic backscatter data.
You could compare it to the simulation and try and fix the simulation.
Right, to use that data in the simulation and to throw out this made-up model and then to use the real data. So that's what I worked on. But while I was doing that, so this would have been around 1981. And at that time, you know, the previous big wave of AI was just getting started. The expert systems era had begun. And so I got really interested in that. And I got interested in it because at Applied Physics Laboratory, we actually had two remotely operated underwater vehicles. So they were underwater robots. And these were tethered. So they were, you know, and so I got really interested in that. And from that, I got interested more in AI in general. And I ended up learning to a programming language called OPS5, which was a production system. It's called a production system programming language.
Yeah, yeah. Production system, so everybody knows, is a sequence of conditionals. And you run down the list, and the first conditional, if that's true, you then do the thing that it triggers, then you go back to the beginning, right?
Well, that's theoretically how it worked, but the implementation was not that, because that would have taken forever. So a guy at CMU, at Carnegie Mellon, had created something called a Reedy network, and he figured out a way to compile all these rules so that you had a network which kind of reminds you of a pachinko machine a little bit. So the tokens, the memory tokens, got dropped into it, and they quickly ended up to the right rules instead of going down this list.
Yeah.
So it was compiled, and it was efficient, and it ran pretty quickly. So
yeah, just so we know this, hang on a second. So routers, current routers in networks, are and the same with most firewalls, they have sequences of rules. And most of them haven't optimized that yet. So they're still doing this sequential search through these things. So yeah. If you could just bring that up to date, and you know, give us the proper mathematical process for it, then you could probably become a billionaire.
Well, how many rules like that does it go through in a router?
Well, so some of them have like 40,000 rules.
Okay, well then maybe they should compile them into a Reedy network like that. But that's an old idea. I mean, it's been around a long time.
Right. This is part of the problem, right? In computer science today, forget the science part, mostly people forget everything that happened maybe more than 5 years ago.
It's amazing. Yep. Yep. Yeah. I mean, all of the work in AI that was done for the last 50 years, nobody seems to remember. It's all gone. Everybody thinks, well, you know, statistical machine learning, that's AI. Well, I got news for you folks. That is a small part of AI, but there was much more to it. And, people talk about, they say, well, you know, these neural networks, they're impenetrable. You can't really see what they're doing. They're black boxes. Well, guess what? In the 80s, all of the systems were completely, could tell you exactly what they were doing. They were completely transparent. A rule-based system, you could see exactly how it was executing. There was no question about it. So,
but we did neural networks at that time too, right? I mean, neural networks are not exactly new.
No. Neural networks go back to, if you really want to trace it back to the 40s, I mean.
Ultimately, you get back to the book on cybernetics, right? The original book titled Cybernetics.
Norbert Wiener's book, you mean?
Yep, from the 1940s, yeah.
So these ideas have been around a long time. But at DARPA, for example, there was a pro in at the end of the 80s, it was a huge neural net program.
But the breakthrough, of course, is the transformer, which is a fairly recent innovation, but we'll get to that later.
Yeah, one of our conversations just yesterday, I think, you know, you made the observation that you realize that things take a long time. And I think that's the abiding thread that I have in this show, you know, listening to all these conversations and else in my career these days, because I'm either explaining to newer folks that, you know, what we're involved with right now is not that new, you know, that this has been framed out by people for a long time. You know, we're just now getting to the point where we're actually, you know, getting into some level of detail of implementation, whatever it is, right? And to, you know, folks, you know, my age and older, who expected it all to be done by now, perhaps, right? This stuff takes a long, long time, you know, and there is invention and innovation and so on and so forth. But, you know, the boundaries of this field, I think, have been pretty well defined in the early days, right? There are ways to do, you know, and I'm talking cybersecurity now, but yeah, neural networks, AI and so forth, you know, things that are brand new today, you know, have been around for 40 years.
So there are a couple of, you know, you're talking about the technological issues, but there are a couple of human issues that have also been around for quite a long time. And the one that we hear is a recurring theme in our shows is, well, I knew nothing about it, so I got the job. It's like, what are your qualifications? Well, I was a mathematician, so I figured I didn't know, but I could figure it out, right?
Right.
And that's it. And he got the job. Today, you probably can't get a job in anything if you don't have an enormous amount of background in it. And that doesn't necessarily make you good at it.
Right. Well, it's again, these are the sort of predictable things that happen along maturity life cycles, right? You know, take anything and say, okay, it starts with 100 people, like Rand, or Ron Ross, or you know, you, or, you know, somebody, me or whatever, you know, who's started in the early days, and there's a couple of people doing it. And if, in fact, it's going to go to 8 billion, you know, in some way or the other, right, then you're going to have bureaucracies, basically, and structures and institutions and certifications and so on and so forth. And, you know, the job market and the businesses and the, you know, operational organizations will model around that, because, you know, now you're talking about hiring managers who know even less about the history of AI or cybersecurity or whatnot than the people who have the brand new certifications. So what I'm saying is it's all kind of predictable, right? And it's the kind of thing that really fascinates me. How do you plan for that?
Right? So I understand, I think, fairly well how you plan for that. But the predictability, this is something that has come to me with age, right? I mean, nowadays people come up with, you know, maybe brilliant, maybe not brilliant ideas, but, you know, they say, oh, here's this and that and the other thing. And you talk about, you know, how it's going to happen. And they're all like, oh, well, in 3 weeks, you know, you're going to give me $500,000. And then 6 months later, we'll have $1 million a month operating. And then a year and a half later, we'll exit it as billionaires, you know. And no, I mean, it just, I'm sorry. How long does it take to sell it? You know, just for each sale, oh, it's going to be automatic over the internet. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Shoes, maybe they're automatic over the internet, but even that takes more than a few seconds to sell it. People look at multiple shoes from different stores. They compare prices. They just don't get it that it takes time. And at every level, it takes time. And then we've been working on, and I think you've seen some of these cognitive models of how organizations work and how you deal with risk and trust in organizations and so forth. And what happens is, at the lowest level of operations, things happen very quickly. But as you move up the stack, they happen slower and slower. So the board of directors doesn't see things very often, right? Maybe once a quarter they'll have a meeting. Maybe once a year there's an annual meeting. So they're not, you know, taking part in those moment-to-moment, day-to-day sorts of activities. And so there's this whole hierarchy that has to get built up of these feedback systems that take their objectives and time requirements from above and feed them to below, and so on and so forth. And it's the same way with the world writ large. It's composed of a whole bunch of these organizations and people, you know, 8 billion people and however many, you know, hundreds of millions of companies of different sorts, and all of them interacting together, and all these decision makers that have to make decisions and become aware of it. I mean, just becoming aware of the existence of this stuff takes a long time. AI was a big hot deal right now, but these same things you see, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they were operating in one mode or another. Transformers, which I mentioned, that's maybe 7 or 8 years old at this point. You know, so you talk about rapid adoption. It's incredible, right? The old saw is, you know, it's, you know, I'm an overnight success after 10 years.
Right.
And, right. And there's a lot of, yeah, a lot of those overnight not successes after 10 years too.
Well, in my first semester at Greenville Technical College in South Carolina, you know, to get my GED, you know, I took a macroeconomics class, and, you know, the phrase opportunity cost, you know, the teacher going through the basics, you know, for a one-on-one class like us. And at that time and age and so forth, that really stuck with me, right? You know, because that's what we're talking about. It's, you know, the opportunity cost of people. How long does it take me to buy a set of shoes? Well, I mean, you can measure it in seconds to sit down and click on something and so forth, but that's not the answer. The answer involves all sorts of complex human things. And, you know, I see time and time again on the technical side, because, you know, and this is, you know, even Hollywood producers understand this, right? You know, a bunch of engineering people have a certain, you know, set of average personal or social characteristics among those, you know, focusing on the technology and missing the humans. And we've gotten better at it. But again, you know, this technology is used by humans, and humans are funny little creatures, right? And that has to figure into everything. So
we actually had a really interesting conversation in my mind about this yesterday with Pete. And the thing about that conversation, there were two things that struck me. One of them is the number of customers he has, right? So we were talking about getting 400 customers in a year, big enterprises, 100 of them, and 300 smaller enterprises, you know, smaller companies. And, you know, but that means more than one a day. So how many salespeople does it take? And what Pete said, now Pete is the top guy in sales in his company. I mean, just the absolute top, more closes, more dollar values than any other salesperson in his company. okay? And in the last year, he closed 40 sales. And of those 40 sales, some of them were not his person. He never personally did any of it, right? It was his reputation, his communication that got it to close, okay? And of those, the total dollar value of sales, now maybe there's recurring revenue here, but the total dollar value of sales that year was maybe three times his salary. And if you add bonuses, maybe twice what he got paid. So obviously the company has to have huge margins in order for that to function. But that's what you can expect out of sales. And that particular one, that's a SaaS, a well-known, globally renowned SaaS solution. Now, you take this to a new product, it's going to take more than that to sell it, more time, more effort, more people. And, you know, you take that to something that's not a SaaS, you know, I mean, you're selling shoes, you have to make the shoes, right? That costs money. You have to ship them around. That costs money. You have to deal with returns and sizes and all this other stuff. So people just don't get it in their calculations. And that's one of the interesting things, you know, building automation to do these calculations. We have things like the sales sieve that is the automation that lets you put in the numbers. But then you look at the numbers, and the numbers people have are insane. They just don't match with reality. So sort of part two, and this is where I think something like AI could really come in and help, is to go look at the actual sales process across large numbers of things. You know, go to, Salesforce or something like that, and get all that information out. And then tell us really how long it takes and really how much it costs and really what number of people go from phase to phase going through that sales sieve. Now, I do it because, you know, I have personal experience and, you know, I have a bunch of companies I work with that do this every day, and we measure them. And when you start to measure it, you can just tell, you look at these estimates and you say, nope, I'm sorry. And they say, no, of course it does. It costs nothing. No, it doesn't cost nothing. It only, you know, it costs a tenth of a cent. Well, a tenth of a cent is like nothing. No, you have 100 million of those tenths of a cent, right? So that's, turns out that's not nothing. That's more than your entire budget. Oops.
Well, you know, what gives me a basis, a lot of my optimism for the future is the inefficiency of the present and the past, right? You know, and, you know, when I was born, there were 3 billion people on Earth. We managed to feed 2 billion of them. And that was it. And the rest didn't have food because there wasn't food. Now there's 8 billion people. We make 30% more food per person than we did back then, which is like a 400% increase. You know, obviously don't have any new land or so forth, you know, but we're still basically throwing seeds in the dirt and, you know, letting animals run around for a while and hoping it all works out, you know, relatively speaking. So there's so much room for efficiency there. There's so much room for efficiency in business. As you're saying, you know, most businesses operate, you know, and it works because all their competitors are the same. Relatively inefficiently.
You don't have to outrun the bear, right?
Right. Yeah. Intellectual property control. Right? Everybody worries about that in, you know, cybersecurity space. It keeps coming up, and you look at businesses like, how are you doing it now? Oh, poorly. Right. You know, basically, if you want someone's intellectual property, you really want it. You know, and I don't even mean nation state want it. I mean, if you really want it, you know, you'll just go get it. Now, I think we'll get much, much more efficient at that, and we'll spend less time thinking about it in the future, which will save time and money, and it'll free people up to be more efficient, more productive, and do more stuff. And I see that all across every domain, right? You know, whether electric power systems, how we use electric power. You know, there's so much efficiency left to be gained that, you know, as we can leverage that, that ends up being the solution to a lot of problems.
It does. There's another interesting thing that he brought up, and that has to do with the lack of memory. So, you know, as you get older, you can't remember what happened yesterday morning, much less 3 weeks ago. But, and that's why you take notes. You learn to do that. But the lack of memory at the scale of the global enterprise, the lack of memory at the scale of science is stunning, right? I used to review proposals, you know, one after another, and every one of those proposals, you know, in my field of expertise at that time, cybersecurity, I knew basically all the technical issues around everything that was going to come up. And people would just keep proposing things that had been demonstrated 15 years earlier to be, you know, you can't do that. It won't work. We know it won't work. Here's why it won't work. And you go review that, but you just get one after another. And the funding agencies, you start to look at what they fund, and you look at the proposals they funded, and one after another is doomed to fail for the same old reason. They made this set of assumptions. They just won't learn. And, you know, they rotate people in and out, and the people they rotate in are people that, you know, didn't learn the lesson from just the guy that just left. I mean, much less from the woman that was there 20 years ago that figured it out. So this lack of memory, and it applies in so many ways to society. You know, this is the history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
It rhymes. Yes, it does. Yeah. Well, I think AI, I think AI does help with this or in coming decades. You know, I think, over the longer term, I think I mentioned on this show, Adventure Time, animated series I've completely gotten into. And there's this 1,000-year-old character. And it is a great little exchange. It says, somebody else asked, what have you learned? It's like people repeat the same mistakes, and maybe it's because they don't live long enough, right, to see it repeat, right? And you see a lot of cycles in the world that are very much based on the human lifespan.
Yeah, I think that's right. Well, not the biggest lifespan, just sort of the average lifespan, because
you only had so much time to soak up all the history, but you're busy, you're doing things, right?
Yeah, and you can have a million people that remember out of the 8 billion people, but they're not going to have enough effect on the world. Nobody will listen to them as a group unless they're very popular, get into social media maybe. But you're right, you get to about 20 years old before you start to do stuff that has that effect on the world in most of our society. And by the time you're in your 60s, that's done. So it's really a 40-year memory cycle. Right now, we're just facing people who don't understand fascism. You know, that was 1940s, 1950s, right? So it's 80 years ago. You know, when I was young, we were talking about the Civil War. You'd study the Civil War, but I'm guarantee you there were lots of lessons from the Civil War that we never figured out, never learned and repeated. So as people get to live much longer, as we anticipate they might, is that going to help fix the problem?
Oh, it'll maybe lengthen the time frame for repeating the same problems. But I think AI actually, can short circuit that for us, right? Because a lot of this is time to transparency issues. It takes too long at 35 years old. I was 35 once. I was very, 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 very busy dealing with things in the present. If I could turn to someone, if I had an assistant who had a team of interns who could inform me of where I am in time as I'm doing these things, that would have been really handy. Didn't have it.
So just to help you out there, I have an upcoming, paper for one of my monthly articles, and we're going to talk about the current state of AI.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
Ron Ross from the National Institute of Standards and Technologies is unique among those in the cybersecurity industry in that he has been in charge of the development of federal standards and specifications for cybersecurity since those standards were first started in their development. As such, his work has probably affected more people around the world than any other person in the cybersecurity arena and moved the course of activities in this area forward at the scale of nation states and global corporations. Here's Ron.
So anyway, at NIST, I come to NIST, I work on common criteria. Then the FISMA legislation, the Federal Information Security Management Act, was passed by Congress in 2002, signed by President Bush 2003. They came to me and said, Ron, would you like to take over this project and start to build everything that the Congress has asked you to do? I said, I'm up for the task. And that's what launched a whole series of NIST publications, federal standards, risk management frameworks, security controls, and then much later.
So let's start with, you have some initials to these things. So let's start with the whole SP series. Just walk us through briefly, how many are there in that series now?
When I first started, there was probably under 50, and now we're probably pushing well over 200 special publications. We don't do a lot of FIPS anymore. That's the standard that's mandated by law, Federal Information Processing Standard. You'll see like FIPS 140, the crypto standards. You'll see some things like FIPS 199, the categorization standard, FIPS 200, minimum security requirements. But we don't do a lot of those. We do a lot of SP, and we do also something called interagency reports. Those are research and development things that are not at the level of an SP, but things we would like to get out there to the public to share the ideas, the concepts, get comments back. But
I mean, the most, but you just published one on the use of AI.
Well, yeah, there was a risk management framework on artificial intelligence. That's not my area. That's another a division within our laboratory, but our portfolio is very broad in that regard.
Give us just sort of 30 or 40 words to describe different things that you cover in this, because it's enormous, it's vast.
Well, I would say that everything from top-level frameworks like the cybersecurity and privacy framework, we do a lot of work in privacy, computer security, the security control, privacy control, risk management frameworks, cryptographic algorithms, cryptographic standards. We do configuration management, incident response. We're now into security engineering. My two publications in that area, cyber resilience, systems resilience. There is just a ton of stuff going on, and it all there's always more work to do. It never ends because the technology continues to race forward. Innovation never stops. The challenges never let up. Complexity is here to stay.
You've done stuff on supply chain, right?
Supply chain. It's huge, huge area now because, you know, in this country, we roll on innovation and technology. That's our sweet spot. That's what makes us a great country. Yet, when you're dealing with a supply chain, as we do, our country, you know, almost all the innovation comes from the private sector. And that supply chain is broad and it's deep and it goes everywhere from a Fortune 500 company down to a small mom and pop two-person company.
You're starting to work in governance, right?
Oh, international governments, yes, around the world. Many of our publications have been adopted by foreign governments. The government of Canada, for example, now is developing a similar program to the DOD CMMC program. That's the big thing they're rolling out to protect the supply chain.
Governments, I said governance. How about governance? You're starting into that area.
I'm sorry. Oh, governance. Governance, yes. Governance is a little bit left of the things we do because governance, we have some of the security consults and works we do deals with governance. Even our framework has a governance component to it. But we don't really dive deeply into governance. We're technical for the most part. We have science.
How about metrics?
A lot of metrics work. We have a new publication coming out. It's actually an updated. It's SP855. It's on security metrics. There's a lot of great information there.
Operational technology?
What is it again?
Operational technology.
Operational technology. In fact, one of the great things about the work that I've been blessed to work on at NIST is that everything that we do, whether it's security control or whether it's security engineering, it applies to what I call the four areas of technology. Information technology is where this stuff all started back when we first came into the business. Operational technology, things like SCADA systems.
Supervisory control and data acquisition. Go on, next.
Industrial control systems. These are the kinds of systems you see on manufacturing plant floors. You see them in power plants, power grids, programmable logic controllers that are really the brains of that part of the industrial control system that keeps the grid, keeps the power on, keeps the lights on. Operational technology, a lot of the work that we've done now is being pushed into those areas. Like our security control, we have a publication where we take all of our controls and we apply them to industrial control systems applications.
How about trust modeling?
We have a little bit of that in the SP800-160 publication. That's the publication that deals with systems engineering and security engineering. We have a whole appendix on trusted systems design, trust models, and things like that. So they're very important when you talk about assurance. Assurance and trust kind of run in the same lane when you're talking about those concepts. So we do a lot of that as well.
All right, so Ron, here's the point. We could continue at this level of discussion for probably another hour and a half without you finding out of things that you've done in this space. This is a vast portfolio. It's unbelievably vast. And you've been running this thing for many years. It's a fantastic endeavor. Maybe almost certainly the leading program in the world. But in all of history, do you know of anybody in any field that has done more than you guys at NIST have done in this space?
Well, I thank you so much for your very kind comments and words. I really appreciate it. To me, I look at this as a team effort. Everything that I've ever done, I've always had great teams with me to do all this work. So, yes, there's leadership. You want to lead the charge, but my hat always goes off to the hundreds and thousands of people who went before me that provided me the education, provided me the opportunity to do what I've been blessed to, not just as a job. I love doing this work. That's why I'm still doing it at 72. I'm like you. I don't want to hang it up because we love what we do. We couldn't do it without the people that stand shoulder to shoulder. So I'm incredibly grateful for all of those people that have helped me get where I am. And I'm hoping to give back. So the next generation, which I'm hoping and praying that we can get the young people as excited as you and I have been about this last 30 or 40 years. I'd love to see that kind of excitement in the next generation. And thank you for everything that you've done, Fred, in your journey.
I just wanted to give people a sense of the extent to which you've been doing this stuff over the time period. It is amazing.
Okay, so does this remind you like of Tom Johnson? I've been everywhere, man.
Yeah, right. You know, and so just earlier today, you know, in social media, discussing with some of our friends, you know, certs, you know, cybersecurity certifications and so on and so forth. And it's, I don't know, I could argue all sides, but on the one hand, I want to be clear with people that this is not a finished discipline. We're still working on it. You know, that's great. At the same time, we need to bring a lot of people up to speed, you know, and we need a lot of work, and certifications are a wonderful thing and frameworks are a wonderful thing. And Ron Ross, you know, just start anywhere. Like, as you say, there's lots of standards, lots of things you can certify to, and you can learn and be educated on. That's great. And it's an amazing amount of work that Ron's done, that everybody's done, you know, work that's finished up this year that I'm really proud of. You know, the working group and a bunch of people and everything else. At the same time, you know, we wouldn't be coming up with these new things if we were done yet, right? So it's, I don't know, it's just all good, right? You know, we had to, you know, it's easy to fall into the, well, you kids don't know, we have been around a long time and everything else. And at the same time, you know, we're moving through the world together. You know, but we've got a long way to go to finish this all up. The topics you and Ron are touching on, yeah, I think it was trust models. He said, well, we've got a bit of that in this, that, and the other, you know, just 180, 185 or whatever it was. But yeah, it's, we've come a long way. We've done a lot of amazing things. You know, the world is running as it should. However, you know, that this is still, we're still building this boat as we're sailing it.
The thing that's astonishing, you know, to me about his career, and this is really the end of the discussions with him, if you just look at the scope, you find lots of people, and we've discussed this before, who, you know, have an accomplishment, and, you know, they have that early in their life, and then that's it. And the rest of their life, they're, you know, trying to get back to that or not. Probably better if you don't try. But he just keeps doing more and more and more and more and more and more. And there seems to be no limit. Maybe it's because we have such a broad and complex field, but the breadth of this is astonishing. And one of the things when we talk about cybersecurity that I think people don't get is how much stuff is involved in it. And I think people just view it as, you know, it's interesting and fascinating, but a niche. But they don't recognize the extent to which it just goes over everything. The other thing is, really and truly, at the rate of, say, one area of the field every 30 seconds, probably another, you know, 120, that's an hour's worth, probably another 120 I could name, no problem. You know, he'd have, oh, yeah, we have this and that. It's just astonishing to me.
It really is, right? And it's... And again, I feel like I repeat myself a lot at this stage or age or whatnot. So forgive me all, but yeah, you know, as Fred just said, you know, there's some folks, it's not that few. It's kind of astonishing. And I think it's a mark of our industry. There's quite a few. I mean, yes, Ron Ross, you know, stands out like crazy. You know, Tom stands out like crazy. You know, but, you know, there's a lot of people I know who didn't just do the one thing. Who've been, you know, may or may not be known for the one thing, but they've been doing lots of things. You, there's lots of things, because this is, it's expansive, you know, information, you know, cybersecurity kind of nails it down. I like that phrase because let's just talk about electronics. Information security, hold my coffee. What does that even mean? I've been doing it for 30 years and I couldn't even stop defining it if I started right now. We don't have the airtime to go through the whole thing. It's everything about everything humans do.
So, which brings us to the problem of scope, right? So when you have that broad a portfolio, you know, you cannot drill down to the bottom in everything. And we've talked about this before. But at the same time, one thing after another in my career, you know, I've drilled down as far as I can go, you know, generally to the physics of it or something like that, and then gone on to the next thing, because you do run out of stuff. And that has to do with the breadth of the field, not necessarily the depth of the field. So Ron has covered the breadth, and he does understand things at a very deep level. I mean, when you go into cryptography alone, oh my goodness, you really have to know a tremendous amount about finite mathematics just to get close to the game. You know, you can't hardly play if you don't have, you know, at least, you know, 8-10 years of graduate education and another 5 or 10 of research, you know, and then you start to become useful. And then you get the young guns. And I love it, right? Because I feel like I was sort of a young gun at one point in time and didn't recognize the breadth of the field that I was working in. But, you know, people get really good at some niche thing. But then if you do that for like a couple of years, red teaming, right? So you can do a lot of red teaming, you know, because you go across the whole spectrum of fields. But if you're just looking at, you know, remote access, you know, to computers by, you know, doing things over the internet, at some point you get bored with it because it's just the same thing again and again. But it's not like you can't move on to 100 other things and oh, well, how about this? How about that, right? How about we look at, you know, remote viewing of things, you know, which is, by the way, that's not a mental exercise. It's an actual physics exercise in remote viewing. And how about if you look at waveforms? Oh my goodness, waveform attacks. There's a career. You could spend the rest of your life in waveform attacks and not run out of that one. So it's just the breadth of it is fascinating. And the fact that he then has been working with teams, lots and lots of people and lots of teams, just completely enriches his viewpoint of this, right? Because he's now talking to hundreds and hundreds of people that have dug into each of those niches.
I tell you, it's a bit of a billboard for our industry. I mean, you want to have a good career, get into cybersecurity. You know, and because as Fred's saying, you have the opportunity to do a little bit of everything, right? You know, I joke, you know, that my career has been like climbing inside one of those documentaries, like Build It Bigger. I don't know if they still make that or not, right? You know, if we get to walk around inside, you know, some, you know, quite often physically inside, you know, the hydroelectric dams and the water, you know, the power systems, and, you know, get a guided tour of how it all works and meet the people who built the thing. And I mean, it's fascinating. It will keep you interested. You know, Fred and I are examples, your entire career, but it's also a great lesson in how everything works. Right. You know, and I come out of it with an understanding that, you know, the universe has a lot of tolerance in it. There's a lot of play in the system. That's fine. Right. You know, you can't, you know, it's a philosophical question. I don't need to be secure. I'm afraid. I need to be safe. Okay. You know, what's up? You know, only for a finite period of time, you know, it'll be no longer than you're alive, you know, naturally. I can raise your security and your safety in certain ways at certain costs with certain efforts. Can't get there. You know, can't keep you alive forever. Can't keep you safe from all threats. These aren't things, you know, and actually getting down to it and applying it and saying, you know, much, you know, just doing it, just saying, I will make you better and taking the responsibility for that, much less what Ron's done and what a lot of us have done in one way or the other, like actually getting out there and trying to come up with guidance, standards, frameworks.
There's another interesting point to be made here, and that is you talk about being in the industry, but being in government, being in the U.S. government, in an agency like NIST, you know, that, and it's a real commercial for that, I think. Because, you know, there's an environment where, you know, you're not generally on the attack side. You're almost always on the defense side in NIST because they won't let, you know, National Institute of Standards and Technology is about standards and technology. But in an organization like that, you can get involved in thousands of different things throughout your career, always learning new things, always getting involved in new things. It's fascinating. And there are very few jobs out there, even in cybersecurity, where you get that scope of things to do. Oh, and you get paid.
And you get paid.
Next week on The Cyber Show,
Pete is the stinger, but without the venom. Rand is shushed by someone unknown somewhere unknown, so he eases off and only does multidimensional symmetry algebra, and that's what's up, Doc. Cognitive defense explains what the heck that even means. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much, much more. Only on the Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time, and bow. A good time, and bow. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time, and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.